Here is Report on America, a series of programs presented by the News and Special Events Department of the National Broadcasting Company with the aid of its affiliated stations. This week, station WWJ here in Detroit. Each Saturday afternoon, we present a story of this nation, one region's civic life, its industries, its people, with the voices of the people themselves recorded during a week's work in the field. To gather this material, NBC has a special broadcasting and recording unit constantly in action. Headed by W.W. Chaplin and other veteran NBC reporters, it covers our nation section by section to bring you the story of our land as the people see it and tell it. Today, after a week's work during which he has recorded the voices of the people and their activities, Mr. Chaplin presents a story of Michigan and the Motor City. Mr. Chaplin.
This sprawling automobile capital is a city of striking contrasts today. There's a spirit of almost breathless expectancy as the population of over 2 million waits to see the outcome of labor disputes, which could mean boom or bust. A brochure issued by the Tourist Bureau is entitled The City Beautiful and contains much to substantiate that claim. There are towering skyscrapers, fine stores, regions of beautiful homes, a civic center and housing project on the long-neglected riverfront. The tourist pamphlet concentrates on these with pictures and almost poetic prose. It fails to mention that the city's Skid Row region stands elbow to elbow with a downtown section of exclusive shops and fashionable hotels. It neglects to point out that in this crowded city with far-flung suburbs, there is no rapid transit system. Nor does it tell how many of the streets are so crowded with trolley lines that traffic is even more congested than in other cities of comparable size, and the parking problem is acute. Though it is the country's center of automobile manufacture and a model of mass production, Detroit yet seems to have done far less than might be expected in helping to solve the problems raised by the automobile. Today, to give a fair and unprejudiced picture of this city of strange contrasts, we have selected features from both the darker and the brighter sides. Detroiters will here speak to you about industry and labor, about an enlightened police campaign to reduce juvenile delinquency, and the voice of youth itself will also be heard against a background of off-the-street activity. First, for the industrial picture. In this polyglot city, you can probably hear more languages on the teeming sidewalks than anywhere else in America, and whatever the language spoken, the words today are the same. Will the coal and steel strikes cause shutdowns and wide unemployment? Or rather, how soon will that happen if the strikes are not settled? Because in volume production, such as in the dominant automobile industry here, stockpiles dwindle with alarming speed when steel stops coming in. Those strikes must be settled elsewhere, and Detroiters can only watch with fingers crossed. But there is an equally important dispute raging right here, which might shut down automobile plants regardless of materials on hand. That, of course, is the CIO fourth round of wage demands, which, as in steel, became much more a pension demand than a wage demand. The wage demand is there, but largely as a bargaining weapon. The CIO has demonstrated that if it can obtain its pension program, it will make concessions as to wages. The United Automobile Workers, CIO, has a definite program of progressive advances against the auto manufacturers, plant by plant. It began at Ford and opened this week at Chrysler. To get the UAW story right from its own headquarters, I went to the offices of Union President Walter Reuther and asked his assistant, Guy Nunn, to let us see the labor side of this spinning coin of controversy. Mr. Nunn replied,
"The contract which the UAW CIO has just concluded with the Ford Motor Company is casting, obviously, a very long shadow before it. That contract took 100 and more days to negotiate. But its repercussions may well be felt in the American economy for the next 100 years. The contract introduces, for the first time in the history of labor relations in heavy manufacturing industry, the clear-cut principle of managerial responsibility for the welfare of its aged or incapacitated workers. Now, that may sound academic, but it's not. Millions of American working men and women know that it is not. The expansion of that system, which is popularly but not entirely accurately known as the free enterprise system, has been accompanied in this country and in others by the growth of a human slag heap made up of the cast-offs of industry, of people too old to work and too young to die, millions of them, left to the not especially tender mercies of private or public charity or a disgracefully inadequate federal Social Security system. From now on, thanks to the chain of collective bargaining contracts, of which the UAW-CIO contract with Ford is only the beginning, the era of the slag heap is dead. The UAW-CIO has once more demonstrated that in promoting the welfare of organized working people, it is at the same time promoting the welfare of all the American people. It's clear, I think, that a new stabilizing force has been applied to the American economy. Purchasing power for the older fraction of our working population is being raised at precisely the moment when raising it is most essential. The specter of insecurity, which has until now been the curse of the working man's existence in this nation, is being dramatically laid to rest. I don't mean to suggest by this that any kind of millennium has been achieved. I do mean to say, however, that a major piece of the unfinished business on democracy's agenda is being disposed of. A tremendous area of underbrush is being cut away, and we are now in far better position than ever before to move forward aggressively toward the kind of social and economic democracy which America must become.
That is the union story. Now for a report from the management side. Spokesmen at Chrysler, where negotiations had just begun, and at other plants where they lie still ahead, they were hesitant to speak, lest they jeopardize their position at the bargaining table. But the giant Ford company has already agreed to a pension plan after 5 months of grueling negotiations. That has placed Ford in a position where some competitors intimated that Ford had in effect forced a pattern for pensions on the whole industry. So I went to the River Rouge Ford plant and called on Mel Lindquist, General Industrial Relations Manager and Chairman of the Ford Bargaining Committee. He agreed to state his company's stand, even though the agreement reached between him and the UAW has not yet been ratified by the union rank and file. What has been your thinking on this matter, Mr. Lindquist?
Mr. Chaplin, we feel our new pension agreement is a good proposition both for the Ford Motor Company and for our employees. It will enable our employees who have long years of service with the company and who are reaching the age when they want to slow down to retire with dignity. And I believe that the length of the contract, 2.5 years, will assure the company of a long period of labor peace and uninterrupted production. There has been a lot of talk since the settlement was announced about Ford setting a pattern for industry. We don't feel that this is necessarily the case. Overage employees have been a particular problem at Ford. For instance, there are 13,000 employees in our plants who are already over 60 years of age. Many of these will be eligible to retire when our pension plan becomes effective next March. Other and newer industries may not have the same problem, and their solution may be a different one. We have carefully considered both contributory and non-contributory retirement plans. In 1947, we offered our employees a contributory plan which they rejected. I believe they rejected it for political rather than economic reasons. This year, we believe a non-contributory plan best suited for our purposes. Many people lose sight of the fact that what we actually negotiated with the union was a working contract. The pension plan is only a part of this contract. And we feel that the terms of this contract will provide us with an excellent working arrangement with the union during the next 2.5 years. The contract is for a longer period than any other ever signed with a union in the automobile industry. That alone will help assure our employees and the company of an opportunity for steady work free of labor strife.
Now for another phase of life in the home of the horseless wagon. This city is a true melting pot of workers from many countries. In the period of assimilation, it was natural that some of the second-generation Americans adjusted somewhat slowly to a society so different from those of their parents' early life. Juvenile delinquency was a real problem. 5 years ago, police officials recognized the need for preventive work. The plan has been so successful that today more teenagers visit precinct police stations voluntarily for a friendly chat or advice than are brought in for violations of the law. The men chiefly responsible are Senior Inspector Sanford Schultz, Inspector Bernard Prio, and Lieutenant Ralph Baker. I called on them at police headquarters, and the senior inspector assigned Inspector Prio to serve as spokesman to tell you about this campaign. Here is Inspector Prio.
Well, this campaign started in December 1944. We believe that the police department had a big part in the prevention of delinquency.
How many members of the police department are engaged in this particular type of work, Inspector?
Well, at the present time, we have approximately 53 men working in 15 police precincts.
And who is cooperating with your campaign, if anyone?
We are getting 100% cooperation from all of the social agencies. We have had many of our organizations, such as the Kiwanis Club, the Optimist Club, the Lions, step back of programs. They've sponsored programs. In fact, we have a large bowling league starting this coming winter, which we'll have probably 400 or 500 teams. And these will be sponsored by our different clubs here in the city and our business organizations.
Well, Inspector, this campaign has been going on now for 5 years. How about the actual concrete results? Has it paid off, and how?
We feel that this program has paid off big dividends. Back at the beginning of the program in 1945, we were locking up an average of between 4,000 and 5,000 youngsters every year. That is, boys were sent to the detention home. In 1948, that figure had dropped to 2,952. Our complaints in 1945, we locked up 12,400 boys on actual complaints. In 1948, we only locked up 5,495 boys, or at least contacted them on these complaints.
Inspector Prio's mention of bowling as a weapon for fighting juvenile delinquency sent me on a trail that led to my learning that Detroit is probably the bowlingest city in America. In years gone by, bowling was in rather bad repute in many regions. The Michigan proprietors banded together in an association to clean their own house and keep it clean. W.W. Edgar, a big-time veteran sports writer on one of the Detroit papers, was appointed state coordinator, actually czar of Michigan bowling. Under his guidance, the business has boomed. Detroit has more alleys and more regular bowlers per capita than any other city. To promote community relations and future business, the proprietors have offered to schools and to the police daytime facilities to handle 60,000 child bowlers a week. I visited one typical establishment called the Maples in Dearborn and found the 28 alleys being used by Girl Scout leaders. And they were followed by 50 girls from Dearborn High School, who get regular athletic credit for their bowling. Here we are watching the girls bowl. The boss girl here today, I guess you'd call her, is the president of the Athletic Association at Dearborn High School. She's Carol Zorowski, and an outstanding athlete in various fields. Miss Zorowski, will you go out on this next alley here, and will you just bowl a strike for us?
Well, I'm going to try.
All right, here we go.
That concludes the latest chapter in Report on America. Your reporter today was NBC's W.W. Chaplin, aided in gathering the material by the news staff of station WWJ in Detroit. Next week, Mr. Chaplin will bring you another Report on America from the industrial supplier cities of Akron and Toledo. You are tuned for the stars on NBC.